Thanks, Theo. And thank you very much for coming. It's really a pleasure to be here in this wonderful place. So what I'm planning on talking about today is joint work in progress with Andre Enriquez. There is sort of a preprint available if anyone's interested in taking a look, but it's all still very much in motion as well. So the problem in the background is that of axiomatization of two-dimensional conformal field theories. In particular, I'm interested in chiral conformal field theories, if you know what that means. And the challenge, the overall challenge, is to try to present mathematical axioms which capture sort of the expected physics, and capture there's really two things you're looking for. One, there should be examples of that those axioms for every model that's considered important, and there should be theorems about those axioms corresponding to that they behave in the way they're supposed to. And in practice, what happens is there isn't one set of axioms, but in the early days, there's many sets of axioms, and they compete, and they fight with each other, and hopefully improve. And in the end, sort of a picture emerges of a good mathematical framework. And with 2D CFT at the moment, there really is no such framework. They're still still at the competition stage. So some mathematical objects you might have heard of, which are trying to capture 2D chiral CFTs, are VOAs, vertex operator algebras. There's something called a conformal net, if you like functional analysis, like I do. But what I'm going to talk about is Graham Segal's definition of a CFT. It was in a preprint called The Definition of Conformal Field Theory that started being circulated in the mid-80s. This is really the prehistory of functorial field theories. And this paper never appeared. So you could get a copy of it as a sort of photocopy. It had, you know, do not distribute stamped across the top. Everyone had a copy. But eventually appeared. But what slowed it down was this problem of constructing examples of the models. So it never really got off the ground. And it may not be as sort of familiar a thing, at least in the conformal field theory case, as the other examples I just mentioned. So the topic today is to talk about actually the idea of constructing examples. But I want to motivate the definition sort of as Segal was thinking about it in the specific example of WZW models coming from affine Lie algebras at positive integral level. So I'm going to start telling that story. And then that'll sort of lead us to Segal's definition. And then I'll talk about what Andre and I are doing to try to construct examples of these axioms. And please feel free to slow me down, stop me, change the direction as you like as we get going. So I'm not sure how much familiarity with these the story of fusion of representations of affine Lie algebras. So let me just do that for a bit. So for this, G take to be a compact, simple, simply connected Lie group. And really, you can think SUN for everything we're about to do. And then I form the loop group of smooth maps from the unit circle inside the complex plane into G. What we're interested in with the loop group is a certain family of projective representations called positive energy representations. This is an interesting little obstacle.
Actually not needed. I don't know what's there. Needed, but...
Okay, thanks. So a positive energy representation of the loop group is a projective representation. Projective representations come with co-cycles. So there is a particular co-cycle parameterized by a level. It'll be a positive integer. And the positive energy condition, so there's this unitary here, which is sort of always in the front of my mind. So representation, I mean, I'm going to say Hilbert space, the Hilbert space H. And there's supposed to be a compatible grading. I feel like you can think of it as an action of the symmetries of this circle. And the way to understand what this grading means is I've drawn the unit circle as well as the disk that it bounds. And you should think of inside the loop group, you have the constant loops sitting inside. And this group should act, should be compatible with this decomposition. The constant loops should act on each HN. And moreover, the lowest weight, H of 0, should be an irreducible representation in an irreducible positive energy representation. So as a G rep, uh, like determines H. And the compatibility with the loop group structure is I really do want to keep an eye on this disk, and it should be invariant under holomorphic maps into G. I would sort of wish I could, there were holomorphic maps into the group. I'm just going to put a little C there, and we're not going to worry about it. I'm going to be a little bit sloppy about whether it's representations of the group or its complexification. So what you do is you see the disk, because if you have a loop on the boundary, which extends holomorphically to the disk, that's supposed to be a lowering operator. In particular, the lowest energy space should be invariant under this holomorphic subgroup. And there's sort of slight lies embedded in here if you know the story well, but that's sort of enough for what we want to say. And then if I fix a level, fix a cocycle, you can ask about how many irreducible positive energy representations there are. There are, in fact, finitely many. And you can draw them. I'll draw SU2 at level 3. I'll draw at level 2. I'll draw SU3 at level 2. So these are supposed to represent the highest weights of the lowest energy space. And this level gives you a cutoff, and only finitely many show up. So the category I'm interested in, write down rep k, is just so the level k positive energy representations is finite, semi-simple. And the slight modification I want to make to this story, then people don't always do, is there's really nothing special about the unit circle. If what I'm going to call a circle is any smooth connected oriented one manifold, you can do the same thing, and you get some category. These will all be equivalent. If I pick some other circle, I could pick a diffeomorphism identifying them, and then end up with the same category. But I just want to talk about, for instance, the loop group. I can add a parameter. And now for any sort of squiggly circle, here's a circle. I have the category of positive energy representations. And this category is supposed to have a tensor product. The fact that it's supposed to have a tensor product came out of physics. This is 84, Belyavin, Polyakov, Zenolodikov, Knezik, Zenolodikov. I can't do those names that well. So there's supposed to be a tensor product, but it's not the tensor product of representations of groups. If you tensor two level k representations as group representations, you get a level 2k representation. So there's an operation that's out there and needs to be found. Now this was actually constructed by Kajdan and Lustig, but I want to tell you about Siegel's attempt to construct an interesting tensor product of these positive energy representations.
This one cannot.
This one cannot move? Oh, okay. This one's important. Oh, I see. So he has this procedure called holomorphic induction. But I want to warm up with the non-holomorphic induction and just remind ourselves tensor product of group representations. And then I'll just sort of stealthily change some words on the board. So let's do the warm up. So now suppose I just have some group G. I'm thinking unitary representations. So you have one G representation, another G representation. And suppose you'd never heard of the tensor product of vector spaces, but I wanted to find the tensor product representation. Well, it's a G representation equipped with a map. Not a morphism, not a map of representations, but from the product. Satisfying a certain property. Well, not just any pair of representation and map, but it's supposed to satisfy universal property. It's supposed to be sort of an initial one of these. So I'm just going to say plus universal property. Okay. So the idea is what Siegel proposed for a tensor product operation was a sort of twisting of this by a complex manifold. So there isn't just one tensor product operation, but there's going to be one for every complex pair of pants. So you should think of this here as some region inside the complex plane. I'm going to label the circles S1, S2, S3. And what Siegel tried to write down was a tensor product operation from, so you take a representation of this loop group, a representation of this loop group, and you should get a new one sort of evolving across this pair of pants out to the outer boundary. And what he said was it goes something like this. So now you take a representation of the loop group on one leg, representation of the group on the other leg. Now I'm going to denote this tensor product operation, which is not the ordinary tensor product. While it's supposed to be some outgoing loop group representation equipped with a map, not a morphism, satisfying a certain intertwining property. An intertwining property is going to be that if I have some holomorphic function from sigma into the complexified group, then by restricting this function to different boundary components, I get a loop. I get a function from this circle or this circle or this circle into the group just by each restriction. And they're very closely related to each other in the sense that if you know a single boundary component, that actually determines the other boundary components. I mean, not in a constructive sense, but you have this sort of relation between different loops, which is embodied by the complex structure on the surface between them. And so the intertwining property is going to be, if I take such a holomorphic function and restrict it to the outgoing boundary, or restrict it to the ingoing boundary, for all. There we go. So this was Siegel's attempt to characterize the fusion product over a certain choice of complex surface, just in the same way that you would try to write down the tensor product of group representations. But in this case, we don't know the vector space to begin with, but still characterized by this universal property. And there were some issues. So I mentioned this paper never appeared. Well, if you just write down a representation, odds are it won't satisfy this positive energy condition. So maybe even before that, does it exist? So we're trying to characterize it as a positive energy, trying to characterize this representation by a universal property. But does there actually exist such a thing? Or if it does exist, so it does, you can sort of force it to exist by abstract nonsense, but will it have the positive energy condition? Will it be a unitary representation? Does it have this nice grating? And it turns out you can solve that as well by abstract nonsense. But there's sort of a third issue. There's going to be three problems, and you can solve any two of them at once. But the other one you want is a certain associativity condition that when you tensor three representations, well, you know what happens in the group case. In this holomorphic induction world, the way you should think about it is if you have a three-legged pair of pants. I've been told to call this a pair of monkey pants because there's a hole for the tail. But you have to do some topology in your head to make it look like monkey pants. So this is supposed to be the same surface drawn twice, but I can decompose it in two different ways. And if I start with some triple of representations, I could either do this fusion here over this surface, and then one more. Or you could do it the other way around. So the surfaces, sort of there's four different surfaces showing up, but they should all play together nicely in such a way. And you want an isomorphism. So in a carefully trained audience, as soon as I say you want an isomorphism, I sort of expect objections. So you don't just want an isomorphism, you want some control over the isomorphisms. What's more, the data of this tensor product, you shouldn't think of as just being the representation. It's also this map that it comes equipped with. That is the map from that takes the vector spaces on the inside to the vector spaces on the outside. And in fact, there'll be if it exists, it will be unique. So an isomorphism of the pair. And if you have isomorphisms, it'll turn out to be unique. So it's just enough to talk about existence of an isomorphism. I'll say a bit more of that later. And what Siegel ran into, so why this paper was never published, was sort of an inability to keep these three, sort of juggle these three balls at the same time. That if you, there's sort of an abstract nonsense existence, which gives you an associate, which is clearly associative, but is not clear as positive energy, or you can force to have positive energy, but the associativity goes away. And this was why this paper essentially never appeared. So it showed up later, sort of incomplete with a with an introduction, and this is why he explained was the issue. So what does that have to do with functorial field theory? The observation is that this construction doesn't just rely, isn't really a tensor product only kind of operation. You can do it for pairs of pants, but you can in fact do it for any complex manifold. So if I take some cobordism, some Riemann surface chopped up in half, so maybe I take something like this, from this you can try to describe a construction where you start with a representation on one side of the boundary, and then if it has a complex structure, nothing I wrote down here cares about anything other than knowing what a holomorphic function is. And so you can do a similar operation this holomorphic induction. And the associativity condition is nothing more than saying that if I have some other Riemann surface, then either I could glue the surfaces or do the operation, do operation one, operation two should be the same. It's going all the way across. And not just the existence of isomorphisms, but the existence of isomorphisms that are compatible with this map. So this now starts looking like a functorial field theory, and I want to write down in the special case of Siegel CFT, it's a little bit different than what you're used to with TQFT maybe, write down what Siegel's definition looks like, hopefully motivated by this should not look like such a surprising definition. This is essentially Siegel's definition. So what is a Siegel CFT? Well, it's going to come in a couple of different pieces. So if S is maybe a disjoint union of circles, then you're supposed to have a couple of things. So A is going to stand for abstract. So you're supposed to have some abstract category. I'm thinking complex linear or maybe Hilb linear, if you like that kind of thing. And then the concrete part of it is it's supposed to actually come embedded in Hilbert spaces. So what you should be thinking is given some collection of circles, I can look at the category of positive energy representations of the associated loop group. And the way I defined it, well, the objects come as Hilbert spaces.
Is Hilbert prime?
Yeah, so I've given this talk a bunch of times and no one's commented on the prime before. So there's an anomaly that I haven't addressed. And the Hilbert prime means that the inner products are only defined up to scalar. And I'll talk about that a little bit more, but it's essentially the central a manifestation of the central charge. Good, I'm glad. This has been a multi-month process of trying to get someone to ask that question. Okay, now if you have complex cobordism, and for the moment I'm going to require that the outgoing boundary be non-empty, and I'll explain why in a second, you're supposed to have the following. So the abstract piece is there is some operation. So I'll call this sigma. Yeah. Should be a functor from the category assigned to the incoming boundary to the category assigned to the outgoing boundary. And this is just fusion in the case of the pair of pants. This is some operation that takes representations on the ingoing boundary to representations on the outgoing boundary, and we had one for every complex manifold. So you think holomorphic induction is what's going on here. But it wasn't just an operation, it came with a map. It was supposed to come equipped linear map, so what you have is a natural transformation from anything you want to put on the incoming boundary. Now thinking of it as a Hilbert space, so it's come embedded in Hilbert spaces. To the outside. And this pair, it turns out, together is much better to work with than either of the pieces individually. So you think of this as sort of the rough analogy with the group case. This is the tensor product operation for a pair of pants, and this is the map which sends a pair of vectors to their tensor product. Their vectors in the out. Okay. Now, the last piece is that if I have a path, I'll be a little bit vague about what I mean by a path. Well, then I'm supposed to get an equivalence of functors compatible with composition, and so on. And there is a concrete part, which I don't really want to say too much about, other than I'm going to add words like chiral and projectively flat. So you should think of the A part as something like a connection, but I don't want to say too much. There's a positive energy condition sort of buried in here as well. Okay. So the A pieces are what roughly you should think looks like a modular functor, if you're familiar with those words. So these examples from affine Lie algebras I was just talking about are particularly nice. They're what are called rational CFTs. And this includes two extra properties, / extra data. So you're supposed to have the category assigned to the circle is finite and semi-simple, as well as allow empty outgoing boundary. So what I've given here is not really in Siegel's paper, but a definition of a Siegel CFT, which is completely compatible with non-rational theories, if you're familiar with that distinction. The biggest difference is the semi-simplicity. So this idea in a functorial field theory, if you're familiar with the classification of 2D TQFTs, requiring non-empty outgoing boundary on your manifolds is exactly allowing a certain non-semi-simplicity in the category, or if you like, allowing empty outgoing boundary sort of forces things to be semi-simple. So certainly in a rational Siegel CFT, the A parts correspond to what's called a modular functor. This is the abstract part, if you like a modular tensor category. And the B part is the CFT built on top of it. So the A's, the category, sort of indexing. We're coming from Santa Barbara. I work with the people at Station Q. So whenever I have a modular category, I want to talk about anions. So these are somehow indexing particle types. This is telling you how they evolve when they smash into each other. Whereas the B is telling you this is the state space. This is how the individual states actually evolve. So in the work on modular functors, for instance, Bakalov and Kirilov, they construct modular functors, the A part for the WZW models. However, what I'm particularly interested in is the B part, is this concrete part. And there's a lot more information. So a question is if you forget the B part, you take this collection of, you have lots of different CFTs with roughly the same categories, roughly the same fusion product, but maybe different Hilbert spaces. And something to note is this is infinity to one. So my particular favorite example of something like this is the moonshine CFT. It's something with where the A part is trivial, where the category assigned to the circle is just the category of vector spaces, or I guess Hilbert spaces, as I've put it here. The fusion is the trivial operation. Sort of the A part contains no information about a monstrous moonshine, and everything about it is in the B part, if you know that side of the story. Okay.
So is that a question or answer?
I'm sorry?
Is that a question or the answer to?
Oh, is that supposed to be a question? No, I guess that's just. The question was going to be sort of how many to one. So I can ask a question, I guess. I wrote the Q. I'll just move it down a little bit. So given a modular tensor category, does there exist a B? So if you have the categorical side of it, do there exist Hilbert spaces sort of sitting on top of it? And this is a question for which sort of quite a bit of interest at the moment. Sort of the most interesting open question would be for a category coming from subfactors. But I think that's another talk. So the goal of the work with Andre is to provide an affirmative answer, sort of this challenge arising out of Siegel's paper, that is actually construct collections of data satisfying these properties. As to try to preempt a why, so I mentioned at the beginning that there's sort of different formulations, there's vertex operator algebras, there's different mathematical constructs which are all supposed to capture the same data. The upshot of Siegel's definition is it puts it all in front of you. You have there's a lot of data, there's a lot of properties it's supposed to satisfy. Sort of, I guess I haven't mentioned them, I've only mentioned them in passing, the most obvious being that if you compose two cobordisms, then it has to satisfy compatibility of this data. So it puts everything in front of you. The downside is that therefore it's hard to construct. But the belief is that it's going to be the most powerful in the sense that there are open questions about VOAs which have been solved in other frameworks. And you can use something like this to address that. I'm getting ahead of myself. Okay. So the theorem, which I said is in sort of joint work in progress with Andre, is actually starting with another framework, which is an analytic framework. So I'm going to have to put a. I'm going to start with for every conformal net with a nice analytic property. This is obviously something I'll have to say more about. There is a Siegel SCFT. So this. Is what I need to say something about. But what we do is take as input conformal field theory in the sense of operator algebras, in the functional analytic sense, and then sort of convert that to a geometric CFT in Siegel sense. Before talking about what a conformal net is, the question is which models does this actually encompass? So I was talking about ones coming from Lie groups, coming from loop groups. So nice includes all the loop group models, models coming from lattices, minimal models, moonshine, their tensor products, their twisted orbifolds, their simple current extensions, their tensor products, their subtheories. So this is a pretty large class of models. For instance, the ones that you might care about are going to be in this list. Something to note is they're not all, I'm not just listing rational theories, or maybe I have listed all rational theories here. So many, if you know what this means, Vera Soro C greater than or equal to 1, so many non-rational theories as well. So what I want to do is tell you a little bit about how the construction works. And not really just for the sake of construction, but because the thing we construct is actually quite a bit more than a Siegel CFT. So anytime you're trying to write down a functorial field theory in a constructive sense, the most common thing you would do is try to chop it into pieces. So you would have building block, simple surfaces like pairs of pants. And then you would take a decomposition, sort of assign the composite from each piece, and then try to show it's independent of how you took the decomposition. The building blocks we use, it turns out, aren't actually manifolds. They're sort of slightly degenerate surfaces. So this is what I'll talk about for a bit. As far as building blocks go, instead of using a pair of pants, I want you to picture, so here is a Riemann surface. It's a pair of pants, but you sort of took the side and pinched it thin. So there's two incoming circles. You want to think of there being three boundary circles here. Here's one, here's two, and there's a third one around the outside. But some of them are allowed to touch. So it's like a Riemann surface that's gotten thin along part of the boundary and the disk. So if you stare at it for a second, you can convince yourself that any Riemann surface can be built up using surfaces. Well, if I use the word surface a little bit loosely, in this case, of this kind. So what we're going to do is actually assign this sort of this number two data, a functor and natural transformation, to something of this form, which looks geometrically worse, but is actually analytically nicer. I'll talk about, so this is, I think, where I'm going to start talking about conformal nets for a second. So this is sort of a natural pausing point, if there are any questions so far. So this is an analytic framework, which is supposed to capture the same information. Conformal net coming out of Hilbert spaces, it's the following information. For every circle, I'm supposed to have not just a category of representations, but a little bit more locality. That means is for every interval, I'm going to make an assignment as well. So for any interval I on a circle, and one of the signs is something which can look like it comes out of left field a little bit, what I'm going to assign is a von Neumann algebra. So first I should tell you how to think about this. You can see it clearly in the loop group example. I'll say what a von Neumann algebra is in just a moment. Suppose I take some positive energy representation of a loop group. You can refine this representation by restricting to a subgroup of loops, which are supported in a certain interval. So the identity outside an interval. Now, in this representation, I can look at the group algebra, not of the complete group. It's an irreducible representation. The group algebra is going to act irreducibly for the full group. But I can take a smaller group and define an algebra to be, well, the group algebra of just some locally supported loops that are trivial outside. And for analytic reasons, we're going to take a certain closure. So this is acting on a Hilbert space and a positive energy representation. And we're going to take the closure under pointwise convergence. And this is roughly what a von Neumann algebra is. It's a representation of a group. It's the group algebra closed in the topology of pointwise convergence. And you have one of these for every interval on any circle in any positive energy representation. And it's actually, at the moment, a conjecture, even for the loop group examples, that this von Neumann algebra, that this closed group algebra, is independent of the representation I started with. So this is the first of a couple of technical issues that we'll run into. But this conjecture is known, for example, for any representation. If we restrict to SUN, then everything, sort of everything that you want to be true will be true. So you have some particular completion of the group algebra of this subgroup for every interval. And then this is supposed to act on things So this is gives you an sort of definition by example of a conformal net, which is to say a certain algebra of local observables for every interval on a circle, and a sector is some is a family of representations on some new Hilbert space. I haven't said exactly the axioms, but you can see some of them in this example. For instance, if I take a smaller interval, I get a smaller algebra because its support is contained in some interval, and it's also contained inside a bigger interval. And these representations need to satisfy similar properties. But it really isn't so much important that you can anything other than what you can just keep in mind with this loop group example. And in that case, the sectors all come from exactly these positive energy representations. So what we're doing is remembering that a representation of the loop group doesn't just sort of tell you what's happening for loops on the whole circle, but you can also restrict to loop support in a single interval. You have a finer structure on the representation. You, in fact, have a representation of each one of these subalgebras that's all glued together. So in fact, something we can do with these examples is we're not just looking at sort of these slightly funny. I've had suggestions for what kind of like article of clothing, if it's not a pair of pants once you pinch it thin, but these sort of degenerate pairs of pants with thin boundary. We can go, in fact, slightly better to what you might call an open-closed kind of setup. So I'm trying to draw the same picture now. But without the circles around the outside. So you have a star here. Sort of this looks like a four-pointed star. And you can do, in fact, assign something to something that looks like this. So what kind of thing would you assign? If you want to take this Siegel CFT idea one step further, is you're now no longer just assigning categories to circles, but you're also assigning categories to intervals. So if I have an interval I, you assign some category C of I, which coming from the conformal net side is going to be just the representations of this particular von Neumann algebra. So given some interval, you can look at this is a completed group of loops into the Lie group supported in that interval, and look at all representations. This happens to be a particularly nice thing. You can start to see why von Neumann algebras play a useful role in this, where for this particular completion of the group algebra I've written down over here, there's actually only one representation. Not one irreducible, there's exactly one representation up to unitary equivalence. So this is actually an extremely simple object. And now if this star is sigma, I can try to write down a functor from the category of, if you like, the incoming, it's not an interval anymore, it's two intervals. So what we do is, in fact, what we construct is not just a Siegel CFT, but something that that takes values on manifolds with incoming and out, where the boundary itself has a boundary. Okay. Yeah?
When you say just one representation, are you putting some continuity conditions on the representation?
I think I'm not. This is one, if the Hilbert space is small enough, if the Hilbert space is separable. So this is, it's a very special algebra.
Certainly if I add the condition
sort of continuous in for the topology of pointwise convergence, say, then yes, but I think this is one of those abstract facts. So this algebra happens to be known as the hyperfinite 3-1 factor. And I believe the hyperfinite 3-1 factor, every star representation. Is wrong. I'm just worried there's a video right now. I would say yes, definitely, if there weren't a video.
I mean, I'm thinking of a counterargument using the Grein-Milman theorem, but anyway.
I am too, which is why I'm should adding the adjective normal definitely simplifies it. And I'll have to think not at a blackboard for a second. So certainly when I say rep here, I'm sort of bundling some things in. In particular, I want to take the adjoint of an operator to the adjoint. And I probably also want continuous with respect to the topology of pointwise convergence. So once you start doing things for stars, you can see the advantage is this thin boundary, which starts looking bad geometrically, all of a sudden starts looking nice from the perspective of these local algebras, is whatever map I'm supposed to assign to something that looks like this, well, it better commute with the action of the algebra for the thin interval. It can either act on the inside or the outside, but it's thin, so it must just move across. Let me say that in a little more detail. So if I so to construct that functor, assign something to a star, what you want to remember is that we're not just trying to construct a new representation on the outgoing boundary. It's also supposed to come equipped with a map. And the map is actually, if you construct them together, is an easier thing to do. So what we're going to do is put a new sort of given h in. So suppose it has actions of these intervals, of the loop groups for these intervals. What we're going to do is put a new inner product on this Hilbert space. So what I'm going to have to sort of black box for the moment, some element we'll call x sigma. So this is something which is very much not just living in one side or living in the other, but it's some sort of highly entangled positive element in the algebra for these two intervals. And you define a new inner product on the tensor product of the two Hilbert space is one for each piece, and what you get, just using this extra thing. Here you put some new, use some operator which mixes up the pieces of these two. You have some representation here, you think H1, H2, use some operator which mixes them up, and you get a new Hilbert space on the outgoing. But at the same time, when you construct a Hilbert space this way, it doesn't just come with it also comes with a map. So you define your new, sort of the result to be the completion with respect to this new inner product. And now if you take some Hilbert space, put a new inner product, and complete, the identity map gives you or maybe more precisely the projection. You just think about something that was in this Hilbert space now being in this one with the new inner product. And the pair come together. The hardest technical part of what we do, and the reason we need a nice analytic property, is that this needs to be continuous. So you construct some new Hilbert space with a new action, but it all lives. There's this, just a single element of the small of the incoming boundary that tells you how to do it, and this is what I'm sort of not telling you where this is coming from. But once you have this, it's not so bad. I now have something that looks like this, and I need to define. So I take in a pair of Hilbert spaces, which have actions of all the intervals of the inside circles. Well, in particular, I have actions of these two along the inside of the star. So applying for this star, you get something with actions of these outgoing pieces. But the thin pieces, which sort of look scary geometrically, so you get so if you have sectors on the two pieces, you get one on the outgoing. Just by declaring that these intervals commute with the map Z sigma. I should really be color-coded. So by declaring that they commute, there's sort of a fortunate outcome that comes out of this, which is that these maps, when you construct a new Hilbert space by putting an inner product on an old Hilbert space, this identity map that comes with it always has dense image. And so if you have an isomorphism between two different ways that result of constructing this sector, which is compatible on the image of Z sigma, then there's actually the isomorphisms are canonical. That was kind of a lost thought.
Question?
Yeah.
So you warned us that you only conjecturally know that A of I doesn't depend on the circle that it closes off?
Yeah, so this is for the loop group situation. So for SUN, it's known. It's an open question. There's sort of many other examples where it is known. For instance, DN at odd level. Maybe it's known for all of them. Other, you just get just some of the representations.
But in your narrative, are you just sort of assuming the conjecture holds for the URC for whichever is like that? Is that one of your analytic conditions?
So no matter what, if once you have the conformal net, you have this category of sectors, and you can build a Siegel CFT with that category of sectors. Now, whether for the loop group models that sees everything is a question about a question of a sort of a certain equivalence of these representations. But for SUN, so this is the work of Anthony Wasserman, everything works exactly the way you would want it to. For the other examples, there's some analysis you would have to do of the conformal net. So there's some of the pros and cons of having different frameworks encoding the same thing is that there are certain questions that are sort of well known in physics. For instance, the WZW models are rational, which is the VOA, this is an easy thing to prove. For the conformal nets, this is open in some examples. I mean, it still needs a proof. So type A is essentially what Anthony did. I have work trying to finish up type E, for instance, but it's still a difficult question. So the hope is that to use this to go back and forth between them. So I should say that the theorem works as well as the things are known about the conformal net. So everything that you want for type A and the other ones sort of ongoing progress.
But in particular, kind of this construction of X sigma, somehow you're writing it as if you didn't choose how the circle closed.
So the place you start is with a conformal net, which is means you have the von Neumann algebras. I guess you could try to write down, really what you should think is that you use the vacuum representation to define the algebra. And then whether it's the other representations are compatible with it. That's where I was being slightly soft. Okay. So one of the things that I've been particularly interested in recently is this question of trying to unify the different mathematical approaches to CFT. So I want to draw a map of roughly where we are at the moment. So there is conformal nets, these analytic objects, which I came into sort of from out here. I was a student of von Jones, was interested in subfactors. Conformal nets can be used to produce subfactors. So this was sort of there's interesting map off in this direction. So CFT is over here, something called a vertex operator algebra. I think it's known there's sort of interesting math off in this direction as well. You have moonshine and the monster modular forms. And then you have this definition of Siegel. So these three points are all supposed to be different mathematical definitions which are attempting to encode the same idea. And you want to sort of build infrastructure sort of theory. Ideally, what you would like is theorems that say, if I know a certain model is rational here, then I also know it's rational here. You would like to. So the hardest, I think you would say the most important open question about rationality of models in these different frameworks is solved in one but open in the other. So if you, for example, rationality of orbifolds is open in VOAs but not so hard in conformal nets. Rationality of WZW models is hard here but easy here. So you would, what you want is theorems that go between, that if I have a corresponding fact here, there should be a, for every fact here, there should be a corresponding fact here, and so on. So the state of constructions, what I'm trying to talk about is something that goes here. So I've been talking about today. To start with an analytic CFT and produce a geometric CFT, this arrow is, I think, supposed to be easy, or at least it's sort of a forgetful kind of arrow. There have been a couple of papers recently. So one, Karpi, Kogashi, Longo, Viner, and then I had one trying to do something like this. And the thing you want to prove is that this diagram commutes. That if I take a CFT defined this way, construct one defined this way, construct one defined this way, and you get back to where you started. If you believe that conjecture, what that says is it's something interesting about Siegel CFT, which is it tells you to conjecture that every Siegel CFT as I defined it actually extends to these funny looking manifolds, that this is actually not a particularly nice property of nice examples we're looking at, but actually that every Siegel CFT extends to these degenerate Riemann surfaces. At least I would conjecture that, at least for unitary models. But there's sort of analytic work that remains to do.
So remind me, so the point with the vertex algebras is that it's hard to, even if I assemble a Riemann surface with a pair of bands and so on, it's hard to show that it's modular invariant and things like that.
Modular invariance showed up early in VOAs. The biggest problem they have is that they're not assigning things to manifolds with boundaries, but they're sort of with punctures. And there's problems to do with gluing. So for example, the genus 1 Siegel CFT is sort of the work of Wang for rational, a sort of long, long, difficult process. And they have trouble sort of assigning anything to higher genus because they have trouble composing the various maps that they write down. So there you don't see higher genus correlation functions, for instance. But modular invariance of characters was one that worked out. This is a paper of Zhu from the early 90s.
So what prevents you from defining the partition function on higher genus?
I'm sorry?
What's the obstacle to?
So the problem is when they write down maps, it's not from, so a great kind of map is a map from a Hilbert space to a Hilbert space. What they have tend to write down is you take some nice subspace of a Hilbert space that maps into something, let's see if I can do this, and it maps into something bigger than the Hilbert space, might call V bar. Okay, something like this. So if you take some subspace and it maps into some bigger space, and when you have maps like this, you have trouble composing them because you don't know that the image of this lands in the domain. So they have these kinds of convergence and domain issues where it's not clear where you try to assign something to a pair of pants and you try to glue it into another one. And so the sort of very difficult work of Huang for rational models in genus 0 and up to genus 1 is trying to do this kind of, make these analytic details work out. And so the place we're coming from is that you never want to deal with anything like that. There's always just Hilbert spaces. They're always continuous maps. And you can just compose them.
I'm slightly confused on the way you're defining the conformal net version of the field theory. It's just a circle with a net of Feynman algebras on it?
That satisfies certain other...
certain coherence conditions. Don't you need something like a Hamiltonian to specify which is...
So there's supposed to also be a representation of the diffeomorphism group of the circle. Then you get a Hamiltonian from the rotation. One of the pieces I'm leaving out is the symmetry. So this is, if you're coming out from the affine Lie algebra side, you may know is the Siegel-Sugawara construction, or if you have a nice representation of the affine Lie algebra, then there's sort of a canonical extension to symmetry of the circle. So at least in the loop group example, it sort of presents itself. But for a general conformal net, you would need to provide actions of the symmetries of the circle. And in particular, that would give you a Hamiltonian.
And then it's just Fujian is zero or something, or does that cover all?
I can formulate it's supposed to be exactly the same thing as a Siegel CFT. It gives you much less. It gives you the observables on the circle. And so one of the things, if you like, one of the upshots of what we're doing is you start with a conformal net, and it produces the full Siegel CFT. In particular, you get the fields. So you start with a Siegel CFT, and it lets you write down sort of point insertion operators. So the packages look very different, a VOA versus a conformal net versus a Siegel CFT. And yet we believe they're equivalent. I think this is going from a conformal net to a Siegel CFT, you're starting with almost the minimal amount of information and producing everything. So this is, if you like, would consider strong evidence that all of these things are, in fact, going to end up being the same.
Are you going to construct X sigma? Or?
I'd be happy to. I was gonna do it.
What's the property?
What specifies it? It is a construction. So what we do, I can tell you how it's constructed. I'm sorry?
You have one.
There's a particular one that we have in mind, but it's not. I can write down. I can write down what it is. So this is very different in a sense than what Siegel was doing, in that nothing is characterized by a universal property. And as I listed sort of three things Siegel wanted, maybe if I was to be more honest, there's a fourth one, which was universality. And we're still not keeping all four up in the air at once. But this is at least some construction. And for SUN, you can say a bit more. So I'm going to start so here's the sigma. And I have a vacuum representation. You can think of a loop group. So H0 being the one whose lowest energy space is the trivial representation, one-dimensional, comes with a distinguished vector. And that vector is supposed to correspond to the disk. So I have a particular vector in here. So the pictures tell you exactly what you're supposed to do when you apply. I have a map, which is supposed to correspond to this surface. And I plug in a vector that I draw like this. And what's supposed to come out? Well, you get the vacuum vector. You just insert the disks. So this tells you what to do on a single vector. That if you plug in the vector corresponding to the disk and the disk, then you get a disk out. But the fact that this map is supposed to commute with the action of this interval actually determines it uniquely. So this plus that uniquely determines at most one continuous map. And proving that it's actually continuous is extremely difficult. Or at least that's the reason that we can't just, if you can prove, roughly speaking, if you can prove that this map is continuous. Then,
an existence, like, or do you have a constructive?
This is a densely defined map, and you want to know, does it extend? Is it a bounded map? Does it extend to the full space? And then the map X sigma is just Y star Y. Okay.
You're saying, in fact, you just know how it acts on one vector, but then giving this commuted property.
That's right. That's right. The image of this vector under these algebras is dense. So that says there's at most one map. But is it continuous? That's a property. Is this a bounded map? And it's a little bit surprising, maybe, at first, that this is a bounded thing. So this is something that I had some work in other examples that came out last year, trying to figure out how to show that things that look like this are bounded.
How do you see it's dense?
This comes out of, let's see. I'm trying to think, so for conformal nets, it's a general theorem, but maybe we can see it easier for the WZW models. I'm trying to think if there's a quick argument for the WZW models. I don't have a quick argument off the top of my head, but I can try to come up with one.
So the status of the theorem, you didn't tell us what the analytic conditions were, but you're telling us that like those are the ones you need for this to be true, or?
It's those, right, so there's supposed to be nice analytic conditions. Analytic condition is just epsilon more than this map being bounded. But I listed the ones that satisfied it. which is maybe somehow more interesting. So that the exact list is the free fermion plus tensor products, subtheories, and simple current extensions, which is very close to everything you've heard of. Okay, we're a bit past where I plan on stopping, so let me stop there.
So we already sort of drifted into questions. Are there more for James?
So using these circle swing intervals, can you compute correlation functions by gluing triangles?
By gluing which?
Triangles.
The shape of the cusp matters quite a bit. So assigning something, you're saying you're going to start gluing together something that looks like this. So it would have to be.
Of course, you should call it hexagons. I mean,
you want,
I want to take each puncture as a little piece, a little circle, and cut it.
So, and even so, triangle versus hexagon is pretty different. So even number of sides, you need an alternating coloring of in and out in order for this to work. But for instance, hexagons, you can. This is exactly what you do: is sort of build. Build the surface by covering with hexagons, and then assign it. So it really is sort of a little bit, it's like almost extended. It almost goes down to points.
But always at zero angle at the cusp?
Always zero angle, yeah, the angle is important. This is something sort of you don't see in the topological lamp, but we really feel the corners.
And I presume somewhere in there was the theorem that like you can cancel one of these one handles with the zero handle of a disk.
Yeah, so it's supposed to be, there's a single thing assigned, and it should be independent of how you decide to chop it up. So there's a couple of, you know, as you do, there's a couple of moves, and you prove that all the moves, you know, generate any decomposition, and you prove that what you assign is independent of, is preserved by all those moves.
So it seems remarkable that from just this loop you get the whole CFT. So. I'm trying to think of some nice word to put on some memorable way of thinking of it. Is it just something like saying if you knew the CFT on a sphere with one puncture, that determines the whole CFT, or some words like that?
So I think there's a strong belief that so everything happens in the vacuum sector in genus zero. I don't know if those count as words like that. So you can recover a 2D chiral CFT from the vacuum sector in genus zero. So the other two axiomatizations, VOA and conformal nets, are both trying to somehow capture genus zero vacuum sector. So the definition of a VOA is exactly the sort of genus zero vacuum sector correlation functions. And this is exactly the genus zero vacuum sector observables. And the belief and the idea is that you can sort of recover everything from that. Just from a
Thank James again.